Join my grandkids with their combined backgrounds in DNA, journalism, and law as Jeremy and Kelly share tales of injustice and intrigue with a focus on true crime in the South. So sit back, grab a glass of sweet tea, and welcome to Southern Fried Homicide.
Welcome back to another episode of Southern Fried Homicide. You know, despite our best intentions, we took a little longer to get this case off the ground. Just been super busy with life, but it's been nice to see some movement in our previous cases. We saw Lorenzen Wright's killer, Billy Ray Turner, get sentenced to life in prison, although it took 12 years later, but that finally happened. We've been in touch with Nancy Little's family. We're supposed to meet, actually, one of her brothers next month for the first time. He's flying in from New York. Also still in touch with the police regarding that case, seeing how we can help. And with Jessica Johnson's family. Speaking of, last month when we did the coverage of Jessica's case, we made a boo-boo. We said that she was born the wrong year. So she was actually born in August of 1979. So we do want to clarify that. We apologize. But we do our best to get these podcasts out hopefully once a month. But here we are, probably a little longer than that. But we've got an interesting case for you today. Kelly, why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
I will. But before I jump into that, I just really want to compliment your fantastic outfit that you showed up to record the podcast.
Oh, really?
Super great. Puffer jacket and shorts, and you look awesome.
Well, I mean, I can't compete with your leopard lady, old lady pajamas and your head wrap. But.
Sorry, I had to bring that up because he immediately laughed when he saw me because I look like Carol Baskins this evening. I'm wearing cheetah
pajamas. I look homeless. It's like I used to care about how I dressed growing up, and I'd see older people and be like, oh, they just gave up. They don't even care. Mm. And that's me now.
My clothes don't
have to match anymore.
It's the great thing about, we're not being filmed. That's true.
We're not on YouTube
our voice.
Yet. So,
you don't know what I'm wearing. You don't know. Anyway, back to today. We do have something a little bit different for everyone this time. We're going to take it way back, and we're going to talk about some crimes that occurred in Memphis in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And unlike the previous cases we've discussed, there's not really a mystery element to this one. There's no whodunit. We know who did it. What sets this case apart is it's just the atrociousness of the crimes. The fact
Use that in Scrabble.
The length of time that the crimes went on, who the victims were, and the fact that nothing much was ever really done about it. We're going to be talking today about the mother of modern adoption, Georgia Tan. Had you ever heard of her before I said I wanted to do a podcast on her?
Nope, never heard of her.
Nobody's heard of her. I've asked both sets of our grandparents, our parents, and they grew up here, and they didn't know who she was. So I think that's interesting. I didn't know who she was until I saw an episode of Deadly Women on Investigate Discovery.
Investigate.
Yeah. She was featured on that, and I saw it was a Memphis crime, and I thought, oh, I got to learn more about this lady. I just am shocked we didn't hear about her growing up. She ran an adoption agency in Memphis, and between 1924 and 1950, she arranged over 5,000 adoptions, and many of them were with children that she had kidnapped personally. And her she just set the standard for adoption, and many of the practices that she instituted back then are still in place today.
Yeah, I don't know why I've never heard about this case, but I guess Memphis does have a lot of crime and
so crime history.
Probably just fell into the cracks of all the other stuff.
I think that's exactly the case. But before we talk about her, I found some history about Memphis that I never knew before while I was doing this research, and I think it's important because it sort of sets the scene and it kind of explains what Memphis was like at that time and how she was able to get away with the crimes she did for as long as she did.
Buckle up. It's going to be a long
it's
ride.
It's a little bit long. I apologize. For instance, did you know that after the Civil War, Memphis was like supposed to be a big deal? Not like necessarily in New York or the South, but it was supposed to be much bigger than it is even today.
What do you mean?
Well, like because of where it was located next to the river, it's a great location. Just a lot of people started moving to this area after the Civil War. So a lot of influential people, planters, entrepreneurs, merchants, builders. There's lots of immigrants coming in from Ireland and Germany. And so it was just set up to be something, a big deal. But what Memphis didn't have going for it at that time was a, a good sanitation department, which honestly, sometimes it doesn't still today. But
if you cross the bridge over into West Memphis, it's a definite stench over there.
Whole different deal. But back then, so they had a lot of plumbing issues. They had a lot of standing water. And if you're familiar with standing water in the southern heat, you know that's a breeding ground for mosquitoes. So taking a big leap here. We're going to talk about mosquitoes for a second. There are tons of mosquitoes in the south. And what they didn't know back then was that they carried diseases, one of them being yellow fever. So in 1878, the first of many rounds of yellow fever hits Memphis and thousands of people die. They think it was probably over 5,000 deaths. And those that didn't die left. They just didn't come back. So all of those influential people who were builders and movers and shakers, they were all gone. And so what was left were the people who couldn't afford to leave. So it was a lot of poor people, a lot of illiterate people. And unfortunately, a criminal element started to take over the town. So Memphis is like a whole different place than it was, you know, 10 years before that yellow fever epidemic. But it's the perfect breeding ground for this guy named Edward Hull Crump, or Boss Crump, as he was known, to kind of, you know, swoop in and come into power.
Boss Crump, like Boss Hogg from Dukes of Hazzard. You probably don't remember that.
I wasn't a big Dukes of Hazzard fan, but he is in kind of a chubby, white-haired old man with glasses. I don't know.
And he was in the politics, right?
Yeah, he was the mayor of Memphis around 1910, but most of the time, his real power was behind the scenes. So when he wasn't serving as mayor, he was actually choosing the mayors. And he did this from 1915 to 1954. He just handpicked who was going to be in charge of the city. So he's just really corrupt. He was basically like Memphis Mafia, like an Italian crime boss, but in Memphis. I'm just really surprised there hasn't been a movie made about this guy. He had everybody in his pocket, police, lawyers, judges, congressmen, senators. He could elevate their career. He could take them down. He would use intimidation, blackmail, threats. He just shunned people out of town, basically. And so it was this environment of hostility and corruption in Memphis. And people got, regular citizens got used to kind of turning a blind eye to all the illegal activities that were going on. And so this atmosphere is what I'm talking about. This atmosphere in Memphis and Boss Crump in particular were what aided Georgia Tan and helped her get away with her crimes.
Oh, is that what we're talking about?
Yes, back to Georgia Tan. Why don't you tell us a little bit about her?
Well, I didn't know anything about her until, you know, this case. But we learned that she was born outside of Memphis in Philadelphia, Mississippi, in 1891. I think Philadelphia is probably a couple hours away.
I don't know anything about Philadelphia, Mississippi, except that there's supposed to be a really cool water park there.
A water park?
Yes. So now I want to go because I want to find her house where
she
grew
investigate.
Up. And I want to go
investigate
to the water park.
Well, her mom was snooty. Her mom was a debutante, Southern belle. Her father was a local judge. So she grew up in a kind of a
Aristocrat's the Disney movie. So aristocrat.
She grew up in a snobby home.
Yeah.
And her father was very influential on her. He wanted her to grow up to be a concert pianist. So she spent a lot of her time growing up behind a piano. And she actually graduated college with a degree in music in 1913. But she really didn't want to do that. She wanted to be a lawyer. So she studied law. Her father helped her with that as well. And she passed the bar exam in Mississippi. But he didn't want her to go into that field. He wanted her to play the piano. So at that time, her career options were limited, you know, being a woman in the early 1900s, to being a teacher or going into some sort of social work. And so she decided to pursue social work.
And this was, I thought her background was really interesting because in this time period, and especially in the South, you know, women getting educated, going to college, passing the bar exam was kind of unheard of. So obviously she was really intelligent. She would have been a really rare woman for her time and where she was.
Yeah. And, you know, getting into social work probably made sense to her because since her dad was a local judge, he often had to place children into homes. There were a lot of there were orphans that had to be.
He had that responsibility.
Find a family for. So she grew up in that environment. So maybe that just felt like a natural fit for her.
I think so. And before she came to Memphis, she worked for a short period of time in Mississippi at the Mississippi Children's Home Society. And there, it was then in 1922 that she actually adopted a child of her own, which again, that's...
And she's not married?
She's not married. That was not even... That was unheard of for a single woman to adopt a kid. Yeah. She passed her... She called her June. Her daughter was named June. She passed her daughter off June as she said that it was her actually her adopted sister that her parents had already adopted and she was legally taking over. It's just a hot mess. She made the kid call her... Sissy. So I don't even know why she adopted her. I have no idea. She wasn't like a loving person who loved kids. I don't know what that was about. But anyway, she wasn't in Mississippi for very long because by 1924, she was fired from that job. I don't know what she did, but apparently she was doing some shady stuff with how she was placing the kids. Her career was just getting started. And after she was fired, she moved to Memphis in 1924, and that's where she started working at the Tennessee Children's Home Society.
And back at this time, adoption wasn't like it is today. There, you know, were lists of people waiting to adopt a child. They would wait many years, or that's today,
that's
rather.
Today,
that's
what,
how we do it.
They're in high demand.
Yeah, it's a difficult process to be adopted today. But back then, that wasn't the case. You just...
nobody wanted to.
Yeah, it was kind of a stigma, not looked down upon adoption was. People didn't want to adopt just a stranger's kid. And interestingly, this had a lot to do with this theory of eugenics, which I had never heard of before. But basically, it's scientific racism. And that was popular back in the 19th century and also with the Nazis, where they only wanted a
specific race
of people, or they felt like that blood was so important to carry on. So adoption wasn't necessarily anything that was trendy back then. And they didn't, people that were adopting children didn't want children from a lower class. You know, they felt like that would make them look bad.
They thought that the kid, if it was from a lower class, it could have mental and physical problems even.
So there weren't many kids being adopted back then because of these...
stigmas.
Yeah. And back in the early 1920s, for example, in Boston, maybe 5 kids a year on average were being adopted. And then, but by the time Georgia comes around, Georgia as in the woman we're speaking of, in 1928... She herself arranged over 200 adoptions. So we can see that she's found something that's working. And
she found a way to make it popular. But she was an elitist. Like you said, she grew up in a aristocratic home. And she looked down on poor people, particularly poor single women. She called them breeders, cows. But she did keep a lot of those opinions to herself, and publicly she stated something entirely different. She publicly would say that adopted kids was the way to go, that it was even better than having children naturally because you had a choice. You could pick exactly what you wanted. If you wanted a kid that had musical talent, she could find you one that had parents who were musicians. If you wanted a blonde-haired, blue-eyed baby, sure, she could find you one.
It reminds me of the movie Gattaca.
Yes.
Remember that?
You
could, like, pick your child's...
Yes. So she was like, this is great. You can pick out exactly what you want ahead of time. You want a red-haired kid? I'll get you a red-haired kid. So she made this popular. She said these kids were blank slates, which obviously they were not. But she started to appeal adoption to people. She did that, and one way she did this was by running advertisements. She would basically, especially around Christmas time in the local paper, she would dress these kids up in pretty clothes, and she'd be like, who wants to have a live dolly for Christmas? Or just something weird like that. But the ads were a really big hit, and people started adopting like crazy from her. In fact, some of the examples I read, people would adopt from her and give the children away as gifts to other people. They were like, oh, I adopted this little girl instead of a puppy or something. Really weird. But she specifically started, she was smart. She started to target rich, influential people, movie stars, politicians, writers. She adopted kids to Joan Crawford, to Lana Turner, to the writer Pearl S. Buck, to just several high-name, influential people. And so, you know, those people set trends. And so common people would be like, well, if Joan Crawford got a kid from her, then, you know, I should too. That must be, like, the thing to do. And again, you know, as I said, she dressed the kids up the prettiest clothes. She took years off their age. They could be 9 and 10, and she'd say, oh, they're 7. Mm. She was trying to make them look younger and more appealing. She would hide their origins. Many of her clients were Jewish and would want a Jewish baby, and she'd lie, and she'd say, yes, this baby's parents were Jewish. There was a Southern Belle, a debutante, and a medical student. They got in some trouble. She would, you know, elevate their birth parents, when in fact that was like just hardly ever the case. That was not where she was getting her kids from. But she did get them. Sometimes she got them in a legitimate way, like with people like dropping their kids off. But
it sounds like most of the time, though, it was through unscrupulous. I'm struggling for words today.
Yeah, in an unscrupulous manner.
Trying to use big words. Yeah. Trying to be like you with your whatever word you used earlier. But she had these she had a posse of people. She had these cohorts. Man, I'm struggling.
She
with
had
words
like
today. She had
shady employees that worked for her
that were around town looking for kids. Mm-hmm. They look for single pregnant women. And they report back to her. Or mm-hmm. if they heard that a person had just given birth, she would show up at their house and say she was with social services and that she heard the child wasn't doing well. She'd offer to take the baby to the hospital, and in saying if the mother didn't let her take the baby, then the mother would be charged mm-hmm. with some sort of, you know, criminal things. And then she promised to come back, and then a few days later she might come back, and if she did, she would say, oh, the baby died and it's already been buried. So she did this over and over again, and she had, you know, other people working for her, helping her round up children. Sometimes she'd go to the hospitals, the insane asylums, mm-hmm. the sanatoriums, and, you know, pregnant women there, she'd take their babies. She had nurses like on her payroll that would, you know, give her tips about which mothers would be
single mothers giving birth
yeah. that, you know, she could, take advantage of basically, especially if they were, you know, they're medicated or something. She would just lie and tell them that the baby was stillborn, mm-hmm. or get them to sign paperwork that they didn't understand.
They're all drugged up and don't know what they're signing.
And sometimes she would just kidnap or steal the children. If she saw somebody, you know, a kid playing in the yard or on the street, she would be like the ice cream man or candy man trying to lure them and then just kidnap them. And then, you know, the parents would have no idea what happened to their child.
And this is so, that's so terrible. This is, again, where Boss Crump sort of comes back into the picture. When he and Georgia met one another, they immediately hit it off. I mean, likes. Wow, that didn't make sense.
Birds of a feather.
There you go. So he recognized, you know, that she was a hustler. And so she would give him money. She paid him off by donating to his political campaigns. And in return, he offered her his protection. And so that included all those people on his payroll. Again, all the policemen, the lawyers, the judges. So, you know, police would then ignore calls where, like, parents would be calling in, say, my kid got stolen. They just ignore it. Or if they did make it to court, the lawyers and the judges would just rule against the parents in favor of Georgia. So Georgia, she let everybody know that she had Boss Crump's backing, and she wasn't afraid to use that as a threat. And in addition to him, her other biggest asset was this judge named Camille Kelly. So she was a female judge at the time, which I didn't even know women could be judges back then. But she was a judge of the juvenile court, and through her, out of the 5,000 kids that Georgia adopted out, she got 20% of them through Judge Camille Kelly, who was kind of one of her spotters. She would go to orphanages and pick out the prettiest kids and let Georgia know about them. So all these people, these are corrupt people. They're all just in cahoots together making money. And anybody else who was aware of what was going on was kind of too afraid to speak out because they knew what Boss Crump could do to them if they said something.
And the motivation had to have been money, because adoption back at that time was, you know, in today's terms, cheap. It was $7 or so to adopt a child. But with that had to happen within your own state. Mm-hmm. But Georgia, she didn't follow those rules. She would, you know, find wherever clients she could, no matter where they lived. It could be New York, California. And she would get on a plane or train and travel. And she would bring a slew of kids with her. And she would charge the family per child that she was bringing as a, I guess, display to choose from, upwards of $700 per child per trip. So that was in the early 1900s. Yeah. And I've looked it up. That was like $20,000, I think, today. Yeah. So $20,000 per child that she would bring for them to choose from.
Mm-hmm.
So money was absolutely something that was motivation, you know, for her. She wasn't, you know, this was all like without, you know, filing taxes and claiming this income. This was all just pure cash for her. So, you know, she had such a hold on the government or was so influential with
Boss Crump
and all those cronies that she actually helped some laws regarding adoption that still carry on to this day. For example, there was one in 1937 that said that out-of-state adoptions would be legalized. So she was a part of that, making that pass. By 1935, so just 2 years before that, she had placed children in 48 states.
So she was doing it. She was doing it before it was even legal.
Yeah,
she didn't care.
In 48 states, so it must probably just the continental U.S. Mm-hmm. But wow, and she was able to work around the law that required the judge to verify that the parents had surrendered the child. So she, in 1941, there was a law that was changed that allowed a piece of paper to be signed and notarized that said, you know, I'm relinquishing my parental rights. Mm-hmm. And so she'd go to court, present this piece of paper, instead of the actual birth parents showing up and admitting or verbally confirming that they're relinquishing their parental privileges. She would just say, here's the notarized piece
of paper. Here's a notarized statement. And that was perfect for her because she didn't want the birth parent to show up because most of the time she'd taken the kid for them.
Yeah. And she was able to do all these adoptions under the table without not too many people really knowing what was going on, at least, you know, from the public.
Right.
You know, she had her circle of cronies or whatever the right word is.
But eventually people did start to take notice. Rumors started to go around. There's no official count how many babies died under her care. But there was rumors around town in Memphis that people saw her workers digging holes at her in the back of her property. She had a property on Poplar Avenue.
And Poplar's one of the main streets in our city, right?
And I think it was kind even back then.
Yeah, because it takes you to downtown, takes you to the east side of Memphis. So she's on a well-populated...
So that's interesting to me if neighbors saw that. That's suspicious. But by 1930... I thought this was crazy. Memphis had the highest infant mortality rate in the whole country. And obviously, she's a large part of why. She didn't commit murder in the traditional sense. You know, she didn't shoot anyone, poison anyone, stab anyone. But it's murder just the same because her babies died through extreme neglect. I mean, they were left out in the heat, dehydration, gastrointestinal infections, things that could have easily been cured. You know, if she thought that a baby wasn't going to be adopted, if it wasn't cute enough, or if it got a little sick, she and her workers were known to just put it in like a stroller and leave it out in the sun until it died. Just let it bake in the sun. Just horrible, horrible stuff. She would take babies from the hospital just hours after they were born instead of letting them stay for a few days. I mean, they still do that today. Babies stay in the hospital for a few days to, you know, check them and everything. She would take them as soon as they were born. And several of her babies died, you know, a day or two after she gave them to the adopted parents because they just weren't well. She took babies from mothers that were suffering from syphilis and tuberculosis, and she didn't give those children medicine, and so they died. But the worst recorded case happened in 1945, where between 40 to 50 of the babies under her care died from diarrhea, which is something that should have been completely preventable. And she just didn't care. She would not give the kids medicine. 19 of those babies are now buried in a small lot at the Elmwood Cemetery in Memphis. And at the time, they weren't even given a headstone. She just, like, dumped them out there. There's a headstone now that's, like, to the unidentified babies that died under George Tan's care or something like that. But anyway, there's no definite count to how many children died in her care, but it is estimated that out of the 5,000 babies she adopted, as many as 500 may have died.
Wow. I still can't believe I hadn't heard of this case.
I know.
Because if it were to happen today, you would think
you would hear about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a Jack the Ripper, just one of those kind of legendary stories, but She's not really considered a serial killer, although, I mean, technically she is, the way she...
I think so.
These babies died under her watch.
Yeah, she
then
just,
she kidnapped them.
Yeah, kidnapped. She just didn't care. And the worst thing about the whole mess to me is that she pretty much just gets away with the whole thing.
Yeah, because right when she started to get found out, mm-hmm. I guess she found out or discovered herself that she was sick. And this all happened right when Boss Crump was losing his popularity as well. She got diagnosed with uterine cancer at the end of her life. And by the time people kind of figured out what her scheme was up to, it was too late. Just 3 days before the state filed charges against her, she died.
Yeah.
So she
got away with it.
She got away with it. They mm-hmm. and oddly enough, what they were charging her with had nothing to do with this abuse of the children, mm-hmm. the kidnapping, the death. It was all about the fact that she hadn't reported the income as taxable income.
That's just disgusting. And then she also wasn't able to like really name names. So all the people that helped her,
all her
more or less
circle.
Got away with it too. Mm-hmm. I mean, we know more about it now, but like Camille Kelly, she just retired. I remember because people started to catch on to her too, but she retired before she could get in trouble. So anyway, it's just a hot mess. Her
it's all motivated by money. I mean, by
greed.
The time she died, she was a millionaire.
Oh yeah. She had tons and tons and tons of money. Her adoption agency was then shut down in 1950.
And when you say agency, it was like a black market.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't even like a...
I mean, people thought that it was legit, but she was selling kids.
Yeah.
But it was shut down in 1950 after her death, and then not a whole lot else happened. I mean, like I said, she pretty much got away with it from dying from cancer. But unfortunately, she left a legacy that still exists, particularly the practice of closed adoption records. I did not know this, and this kind of blew my mind. So as I said earlier, she falsified records. She would change the age of the children. She would change the background of them. She falsified their birth certificates. So she stated that on their birth certificate, she stated that the adoptive parents were the child's actual parents. And she said she did this to protect the child from the stigma of being born out of wedlock,
yeah.
or to protect the privacy of the birth mother. But what she was really doing this for was to protect herself. She did not want people to find out where she was getting these babies from. And unfortunately, this closed adoption record process is often very common today. I mean, some adoptions are open. You know, sometimes the birth parents mm-hmm. and the adoptive parents, they work together. But a lot of times they're closed. And a birth certificate would still be issued saying that the adoptive parents are the child's, you know, actual parents. And these records are usually still sealed and very difficult to get to. The United States is actually one of the only countries in the world that still follows this practice. In fact, most of the states in the United States do this. I think Kansas and Alaska were two of the exceptions, but they legally forbid adopted adults from knowing who their birth parents are. They have to jump through all these hoops and hire private investigators and take DNA tests and mm-hmm. to really find out who their birth parents are.
Yeah. Back at the beginning of the pandemic, when work was a little slower, I started volunteering on a Facebook group called DNA Detectives, and most of the people that are there that are searching for family are either adopted or their mother just didn't know who the father was. And this one lady I helped was in a similar situation. She was not in the South. I think it was the Midwest, where she was born, and the midwife, I believe it was, told her family that that the baby died. But in fact, the midwife just took the baby into the back of mm-hmm. the building and sold her. So as an adult, she grows up. When she's of age, she goes to get her birth certificate, and she sees two names on there that she believes to be her mother and father. And she goes through years and years and years of research trying to find these people who don't exist. I mean, they had birth dates and what city they were from. She spent all kinds of time and effort posting on websites like, please help me find my family. I'm looking for, you know, the Williams or whatever it was. And so eventually she took an ancestry test, the mm-hmm. DNA test, which will show you who you're related to. Mm-hmm. And so myself and another gentleman were able to help her identify who her biological family is. Wow. But this apparently around this time, because I believe she was born in the 40s or 50s, if memory serves me correctly. Mm-hmm. So this just must have been a popular...
That's just so crazy.
...thing to sell babies.
Yeah. And it's still... A lucrative market.
Yeah. I mean, you think about it on an international scale where people are adopting babies from other countries mm-hmm. now, from the U.S. They will spend, you know, all kinds of money, $40,000 or more to right. get a baby from another country. But how are those babies being obtained? Right. You know, are those people...
Are they getting those children through a legal way
right.
or not? Right. Because, I mean, and again, you know, the people that who can afford to do that are movie stars. Mm-hmm. Just like how Georgia Tan targeted Joan Crawford and Lana Turner. It's often movie stars that do this.
Turns out that Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt, mm-hmm. Their oldest son, I believe, was adopted from Cambodia.
Yeah.
And the woman who was in charge of that operation, her name was Lauren Galindo. She got later charged with child trafficking and saying that she had made almost $8 million arranging 800 wow. adoptions of Cambodian children. So that's just an example of how stealing babies and selling them is still
around.
That's a problem today.
So yeah, what a legacy she left behind. I think the only good thing you can say about Georgia Tan is that she did get people interested in adoption.
It's kind of like I've heard about Satan, you know.
He's
a hard worker.
Yeah, that's what she was a hard worker.
Trying to find something positive in everybody.
But I can't help but think, I mean, if she hadn't done this, I still think somebody else would have come along and made adoption popular.
The other, you know, the case of the woman I helped, right. There was other people doing this bad stuff.
But somebody else could have made adoption popular and not made it so terrible and kidnapping kids and all that stuff. I think the whole thing researching this that I cannot get over is that we grew up here. I drive on Poplar. And my grandparents grew up here.
You think it'd be like in the museum or some sort of...
Why did we never hear anything about this? Because, like I said, I mean, all those deaths and then the practices that she did back in the day, many of them still exist today. And... Nobody knows who she is. Well, Investigate Discovery apparently knows who she is. But nobody else knows who she is.
Yeah, and then the fact that the abuse that the children went through with who they were
horrible.
Placed with, you know, she didn't...
She did not do background checks on people.
No,
if they had money, she would give them a kid. They could be pedophiles. They could be wanting slave labor. She did not care. So these kids got adopted into some terrible homes.
Yeah, and it's just sad that you know these people probably have grown up with some sort of shadow or cloud over them, you know, not knowing who they really are. If they were adopted, they may have felt like, oh, I don't really belong to my family. Mm-hmm. They may not even know that they're part of this legacy.
Right.
But it'd be interesting to talk to somebody who...
Oh, I know.
...who has been impacted directly, you know, as a descendant in Memphis. I'm sure there's...
Oh, I think there would have to be. And I know we both have always thought that adoption is just a wonderful thing. And it is. It's absolutely wonderful.
There's some show that used to come on TV like every year or something that would show all the kids that were orphans mm-hmm. and that needed, you know, I'd go online and just want to adopt all of them. It has a special place in my heart. Adoption does, I think.
Oh, I think it's wonderful.
It can be a beautiful thing.
But I hate when so that's why I was so disturbed researching this, because I had no idea some of its background and some of its origins, and unfortunately many of it starting with her. Mm-hmm. So just a terrible woman. She was despicable. Maybe it's best that she is forgotten, because she was just a horrible, horrible person. You know, if anyone is listening and knows of a Georgia Tan baby or the descendant of one,
hit us up. We'd love to talk to you.
I would love to hear their life story and their experiences.
How did they find out?
Yeah, because I know there has to be some local, because like I said, she's from Memphis, so there has to be some nearby. So if you could, you know, reach out to us, we would love to know. And my heart just goes out to her victims, both the babies and the parents who mm-hmm. she stole their children from. It's just a it's complete
generations
nightmare.
Generations ago now, but there's...
It still leaves an impact
yeah.
on them. Absolutely. What an
interesting case. I'd never heard of it before. And when you mentioned it, I'm like, who? What?
She's just this... And if you look her up, she's just this unassuming, kind of chubby old lady kinda with short hair and glasses. She looks like a grandma. You know, I can see how people would trust her because she just looks like an old grandma, but she was just a mean, terrible person. She and really
you,
was.
You mentioned to me earlier today about when she died and how she had adopted someone to leave her money to mm-hmm. when she died. But the way, I mean, it was not a child. She right. like adopted,
she adopted
some,
an adult.
An adult, still. Scheming, still oh, trying yeah. to circumvent the laws to allow her her estate to pass yeah. to somebody else. She's oh, just she's from the very beginning.
Oh yeah,
she, the foundation of her life mm-hmm. in adopting, quote unquote, her daughter, making her call her sister, down to when she died, was yeah. just built on lie after lie after
sneaky,
lie.
Sneaky, crafty woman. So yeah, you were like right what you said about Satan, the devil. He's a hard worker. So is she. She was smart and she was a hard worker, but that's pretty much all you could say about this woman. Georgia Tan, she's a horrible lady. Look her up.
I'm sure, yeah, and to your point earlier, there's, I haven't heard, you know, where's the movie? Where's the, but you did say there was a TV movie.
There's a Mary Tyler Moore Lifetime Ooh. Movie I watched.
It's not on Investigate.
I mean, I think I found it on YouTube or something, but, yeah, I think it's called Stolen Babies. I think a lot of it's been fictionalized, but it was still pretty interesting. It's worth checking out. Stolen Babies with Mary Tyler Moore. It's like a 1990 Lifetime movie. I love those.
We thank you guys for bearing with us.
As we ramble a lot yeah, today. Well,
but it's been a while.
Yeah.
You know, we're looking forward to our next case. We're trying to alternate cases, one where... it's maybe been solved. We know the ending, and then another one where we don't. There's so many thousands and thousands, surprisingly, missing people.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things I've been researching is unidentified people, Jane Does, John Does, and then matching that up to missing people. And there's just a lot here locally, but anybody who's listening to the podcast, if you just go and type in whatever state you're listening from, missing people, you're going to be blown away.
Yeah,
they're just forgotten. So we'll try to focus on some of those cases too.
Yeah, I think that would be really good. And we need to probably branch out of Memphis a little bit. It's just
there's so much to choose
just
from.
So
here.
Many here, unfortunately.
Definitely want to.
But we do. We always appreciate everyone's support. Any case recommendations that you might have, let us know.
Yeah, that's how we got to the Jessica.
Yeah.
Case.
So yeah, we do. We definitely want you guys to let us know. We appreciate you listening. Appreciate you listening to me talk about mosquitoes for a really long time. I know that probably was like, oh my goodness, where is this going? But we would very much appreciate if you would give us an online review on whatever podcast platform you listen to us on. And remember to follow us on social media, on Facebook and Instagram at Southern Fried Homicide Podcast for any updates on past and future cases that we're covering. And again, join us next time for more tales of the dark side of the South.